Okay. During the break, somebody asked me some more questions about the Oxford Group, and there was some stuff that I had skipped over because of time, and that I thought I'd bring up real quick, and that was there was a point where Alcoholics Anonymous got to, Central Office had become a sort of a clearinghouse for problems. A woman worked in Central Office in the early days, in the beginning, named Ruth Hawk. And basically, she was really good at keeping track of, filings and questions that were coming in. People from all over the country were calling into the Central Office to ask, like, what do I do for this and what do I do for that? She would keep files on the similar questions, and it got to the point where there was traditional answers to give for certain things. In the beginning, there was a lot of problems because there was fighting over what should be right or what should be wrong, what should be right or what was wrong. Bill would get calls like, oh, there's this guy in Florida who's charging for Alcoholics Anonymous. So Bill contacted the guy and says, hey, I hear you're charging people for the program. And the guy said to Bill, yeah, we found that people just take this thing a lot more serious when they have to pay for it. And besides, we're sending you guys all the money to Central Office there. So they were they were hurting for money, so there was certainly no argument with that, and there was no traditions against that. There was no traditions at all at the time. But there was also a lot of issues of who should be allowed to go to a meeting and who shouldn't. Especially in the South, there was complaints how people were treating people, like when blacks would try to come into their meetings, and there was just exclusivity. Did I say that right? But out of all of these problems that were going on, somebody came up to Bill and said, Bill, this is starting to look just like the Washingtonians. And Bill really didn't know much about the Washingtonians, but it triggered some investigation as far as who they were. And it was a group of guys, half a dozen guys decided to get together in the back of a bar in about 1835, about 100 years before Alcoholics Anonymous. They'd meet in the back of this bar just to help each other stay sober. And this situation just got so popular that it grew actually faster than Alcoholics Anonymous in its early times. And they just allowed everybody in. There was addicts that they let in, but there was naturally different drugs at the time. There was abolitionists. There was government, causes, and it became a forum for whatever bothered people. They would get together to discuss it, and although it grew much faster than Alcoholics Anonymous, it also disappeared completely within a short number of years. Which sort of made Bill look at this thing and says, are all these problems going to bring Alcoholics Anonymous to the point of distinction? Instinction? So Bill started looking at the problems that affected the Oxford Group, like Buchman. Buchman thought that if he would go talk to Hitler, that he could bring Hitler to God, and that through that process, that the killing would stop and the war would stop. And Buchman got branded from the Oxford Group, got branded a Nazi sympathizer. All right, so these outside issues affected the Oxford Group. But try to find an Oxford Group meeting today, right? They actually, you can, they've changed their name. It's the Moral Rearmament. You can find them on the internet. I don't know if they're in this country anymore, though, but I'm sure you'd find out on the internet. But the issue here is that they realized that they have to have some kind of guidelines in order for Alcoholics Anonymous to survive, and hence the 12 traditions. And they were trying to decide what to call them, because they knew that alcoholics wouldn't like anything called rules or laws but what they came up with was the word traditions. And basically it was based on what, up to that point, they were traditionally doing. And they set it up in such a way that they realized that in order for Alcoholics Anonymous to grow, that they had to be loose enough to be able to grow with the group or evolve with the group, or with Alcoholics Anonymous over the years. So, so as you study the traditions more and more, you see this, that the individual groups themselves really have a lot of say in what their meetings can do, as long as it doesn't affect AA as a whole. But through this organic process, Alcoholics Anonymous is set up in such a way that it's managed to live quite a long time for an organization with this kind of, with a structure like this. It's sort of like an upside down of what's normal. You'd expect there to be, the leader of Alcoholics Anonymous would be at the top, and then everybody working underneath them, like a corporation. But it's sort of like an upside down triangle, with whoever's in charge is really at the bottom, supposedly doing what everybody above them wants them to do, expects them to do for them. And at the top is the membership as a whole, and how it guides the service structure. So, thus was the importance of the 12 traditions. And, in order that for Alcoholics Anonymous to be around here for my children and my grandchildren, right? So I'd like you to turn to the doctor's opinion. In my third edition, it's XXIII, Roman numeral 23. In your fourth edition, it's Roman numeral 25. When they added the foreword to the fourth edition, it kicked up the doctor's opinion 2 pages. Now, the basic instruction for this for the doctor's opinion here is actually, you'll find it on page 9 of the workbook, where it talks about the physical craving. Here's where we start to look at the physical part of my problem, the physical part of what's wrong with me, right? And I have a little prayer there. It's, God, please enable me to set aside everything I think I know for an open mind and a new experience. Help me see the truth about my physical craving after I start to drink. Right. So, and if you notice in the book, there's some stuff written in regular type and there's some stuff written in script. The reason for the difference is that everything in script, if you write it into your big book, it will turn your book into a working with others book. You can certainly go through this on your own and figure out how to do it. But once you set your book up as a tool to work with others, then you could sit across from another alcoholic that you're working with, and it becomes a reproducible method to work with others. And it's proven to be highly effective, and the proof for me is how many great grand sponsees and great great grand sponsees I have the opportunity to meet, and they're all using the big book. So it's a method to show people how to use the big book to work with others, right? And there's plenty of room for my opinions to go around that when I'm sitting with them, right? But it's around what the book is saying. And as long as I have this line to stick around close to, it can't veer too far off of what the big book says. I guess it depends who's presenting it, right? But we'll try to stick to what the book is saying. And but here, what you'll see in the first part that's in script here, it says, step one, physical craving of my body. Right? And we'll see that from the beginning of doctor's opinion through the top paragraph on page 23. That's the section that will look at the physical part of the of what's wrong with me. The first step begins here. We start by using the doctor's opinion as a tool by turning the statements into questions to look at what happens to me after I take the first drink. And if you had drugs in your story, you might want to consider both. What happens to me when I take the first drink? What happens to me when I start using the drugs, right, to take the first hit? Right? This has nothing to do with your thinking at the time. Look mainly at what happened. Right? This is not about what you think about the first drink, but about what happened. Right? And there's a consideration. It's, do I lose control of my drinking after I take the first drink? Right? Or can I control how I drink after I've started? And if so, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Right? You know, I've worked with people who when going over these considerations, realize they can control how much they drink after they start. You know, but once they start with the cocaine, they lose all control. Right? Give the people you work with the dignity to find out what's true for them. I'm not one that believes that just because you're here, you're an alcoholic. Right? And even if I think that you are, it's important that you know that you are. So to have an open mind, come to this thing is, okay, well, what makes me an alcoholic? You know, once I'm thoroughly convinced, then hopefully I'll have less chance of sitting around here 4, 5, 10 years thinking in the back of my mind is, maybe I really didn't need this. Maybe I could have really stopped on my own and I don't need to go to these meetings. Right? I have to know what's true for me, and I have to be convinced of it at a level deep down inside, because as we read in the forewords, is once I know what's wrong with me and what the truth is about that, you know, then I'll pursue the spiritual solution like my life depends on it. Right? But I have to be convinced so that the level of the first step experience and my powerlessness will designate how hard I need that solution or how badly I need that solution. Right. So we don't have time to go through this line by line, but when I sit with people, that's what we do. They fill out the notes in their big book before we get together. It's kind of like homework. Right, so they're not writing while we're together. And I have them read the paragraph, and I interrupt with the same questions that they've written down. So it effectively does a couple things, and that is, one, certainly it poses these questions that if a lot of people have given me input into trying to keep it close to what, as close as possible to what the big book is saying. Right? And the other thing is it's showing them how to work with others right from the beginning. Right? Because I don't know, you know, how many of you have taken people through the steps, and you get to the point where you try to encourage the person you're working with to go work with others, and they say, well, I don't remember what we did in the beginning, right? So, you know, it's just let them read the paragraph, interrupt with the questions, you know, and I usually don't get to have a second conversation with the people that I work with when they come to me at first, like, I don't know about this, I don't know how to do this. I just say, just let them read the paragraph, interrupt with the questions, you know, and I've never had a second conversation about it, like it didn't work for me, it didn't get it, you know, and you'll see that doing this, that it just, you know, you start to see God working through your life when you're doing this with people, you know, intuition just comes. So what was it about the doctor's opinion that was so earth-shaking to Bill Wilson and then afterwards to Dr. Bob Smith, that was enough to move them to the place where they realized that they needed the spiritual solution. Right. Well, on this second page of the doctor's opinion, he talks about in the paragraph that starts off the physician who, if you go to the last sentence, it says, in our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out the physical factor is incomplete. All right. What he's talking about here is there's a physical part of my alcoholism, right? Again, this is nothing to do with what I'm thinking. That when I take that first drink, something happens in my body, right? Certainly something is going to, we're going to talk about our mind later, but what I have to see is that there is something that happens in my body, right? Sometimes my perception of it is as simple as, I think another drink would be nice, right? But when I have any good reason to not get drunk, and I do anyway, setting aside all of that stuff that goes in my mind, what the doctor here is presenting is the idea that once I start, my body craves physically another drink. Cocaine addicts have a real easy time with this one because they don't, you know, it's pretty obvious to a cocaine addict, they don't need to be told that once they start, they lose control. But with alcoholics, some alcoholics catch it right away and know it, and some don't. Obviously, Bill and Bob didn't think that there was a physical, didn't understand this physical thing. And it was it's a big problem because, I mean, how many times did I get 3 days or a week off of drinking and thinking, well, okay, I got control of it now. I can go have a drink, right? You know, but then I end up drunk again and back in that same place. And what happened, right? So the doctor presents the idea that on the next paragraph, where it says the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. All right. So what's an allergy? An allergy, back in those days in the 1930s, was kind of different than it was now, right? Because there was no allergy doctors, right? If you were allergic to bee stings and you got stung by a bee, the only thing they could do is rush you to the hospital, poke a hole in your throat so you could breathe until the swelling goes down, right? If you had a child who had allergies to something in your area, if they were really bad allergies, you'd have to quit your job, sell your house, move to another town, and hope that you could find a place that doesn't have that thing, that substance. You couldn't go to the drugstore and find an aisle full of allergy medications, right? There was nothing for it. And so here you got a life-threatening problem, right, that affects some people, that where these substances affect a person in a life-threatening manner, and it doesn't do it to everybody, right? Many people don't have that effect, right? And there was no cure for it, right? So in that sense, right, the idea that alcohol affected me in a manner that didn't necessarily affect some of the people that I hung around, right? I drank to the point where it certainly was life-threatening. You know, it was my life, right? It didn't affect everybody like this, but with me, I consistently drank too much and didn't understand why, right? So in that sense, it says, as laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as an ex-problem drinker, we can say that this explanation makes good sense. It explains many things which we cannot otherwise account. So that would explain it. That would explain why was it that I was in situations like, you know, had clients that we'd go out to a bar for a few drinks or maybe dinner, and they'd leave me there because I was drunk and they were done, right? They were just finished. Yet I started to drink and I continued to drink mindlessly of the situation around me, right? I wanted to make a good impression. I didn't want there to be negative thoughts about me. This was a client. I had every reason in the world to control my drinking, at least while he was there, and I didn't. Right? You know, I had a wife at the time, near the end, before I got near the end of my sobriety. Near the end of my drinking, who was greatly affected by the way I was drinking. Right? And I had many good reasons to, be mindful of that I had to be should have been home at certain times and that I should have, yet I could easily just go to lunch, which when my friend Jose was a neighbor next to my company, he would come over and he would say, "Come on, let's go get some lunch," and that meant let's go to the bar, and easily just stay out all afternoon drinking, because that's what lunch meant to us, right? Completely unmindful of that I had a business to run, and I wouldn't say that it never occurred to me, but for many years I could easily rationalize it off, like, well, there's people there taking care of stuff, and I just won't get too drunk, right? Never thinking that maybe I really didn't have a choice in the matter. You know, ever wake up in the morning telling yourself that you're going to do certain things that day and go through the day and you realize you haven't done any of those things, right? That was sort of the way the drinking went. It was like I'd say, okay, well, we're just going to lunch. I have all this stuff that I'm going to do, and we start drinking, never intending to go lose control, and just, all of us, just got to the point where the drinking was just more important, right? And I wouldn't say that that was going on in my mind, but it was certainly going on in my body. Right? Okay. So, as the drinking progressed, people started to notice. The wife started to talk about it, and certain people started to get concerned for my well-being and the way I was living. And it was easy to say, "Well, I'm not hurting you. This is my life." That kind of attitude. Why should you give me such a hard time about it? Nothing's really wrong here. And I really didn't believe that there was anything wrong here, because I was doing what I wanted to do, living the way I wanted to live, and the fact that I was drinking too much wasn't necessarily a problem for me at the time, but it was certainly so. The fact that it was a problem for other people, I felt that it was more your problem than it was my drinking, right? So you can relate to that, right? And as selfish as that was, I believed it. And the fact is that I went many years like that, only concerned with myself and what I wanted to do. I mentioned a little bit of this yesterday, I remember thinking that how nice my first wife was when I married her, how quiet she was and didn't bother me about anything, and she turned into such a monster. Never realizing that, I was particularly responsible for driving her insane. Not coming home, the phone calls saying I've got too much work, I'm gonna have to stay at work, it's because I was half an hour away from where I lived. I would just sleep in my office, and there really was no work. It was just It was just the way I was living and what I was and how how I was drinking. And you know, and that went on for a long time, and as time went on, I realized that my drinking started to affect situations. I would make commitments, like appointments with people, and some of them were very important, and concerning work, and avoided the appointment altogether because I ended up drinking drinking too much, and just would rather continue to drink rather than make that appointment. You know, so situations got harder and harder because work, you know, it's hard to keep a business when you're not doing any sales and you're not applying any time to it, and you're depending on people just to keep things rolling that you've already got rolling. You know, and anybody who's ever had their own business knows that a business doesn't hold up well to such bad management. And naturally, that eventually collapsed, but that's later on. There's a statement here in the book on page XXV, III in the third edition, but that would be, I guess, would that be XXX in the fourth edition? Let me check here. Yeah, XXX, where it talks about the supreme sacrifice. In the Webster's Dictionary, I got a definition for supreme sacrifice. It's like a soldier giving his life for his country. Right? I know it has some other biblical definitions, and some people consider it suicide. But when I read that in the Webster's Dictionary, giving like a soldier giving his life for his country, and looking at that and the way I was living and the way I was drinking, and I saw it, you know, I was giving my life up to drink. Right? Alcohol and that way of life became more important to me than my business, than my marriage, right? Than my dreams. Right? Eventually getting me to the point where I was looking down the barrel of a 357 Magnum, thinking, this is going to be the only way I'm going to stop drinking. You know, I didn't completely understand that. You know, I didn't know why that was, because I didn't catch that idea that I couldn't start drinking without losing control. I would get a little bit of time. I would fight to get a little bit of time from it, and the thought would just pop into my mind is, 3 days is good. You know, look, there's no problem here. You know, I'm just gonna get a little tequila and there I was again, right? Because there was something that I didn't understand, and that's gonna be coming up. I'll touch on that in a minute. When we get to, if you go, turn to Bill's story, which is page one. This is still, I consider this still the first half of the first half of step one, the physical part of the problem. You know, the physical part of the problem. I use Bill's story as a tool to compare my life to Bill's life, right? And what I like to do is, as I go through and read this, I like underline everywhere where I relate to what Bill says, setting aside the differences, though. He was in the service, I wasn't in the service. He was in Europe, and I wasn't in Europe. But at this, when I started drinking. But he makes the statement in this first paragraph I was a part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. So that's a great question. Where did I feel that I was a part of life at last, and in the middle of it, with the discovered the alcohol, right? You know, and for me, I go through this and make little notes in the margin, you know, because for me that was the gas station that I talked about yesterday, this gas station in Culver City that I used to hang around with, and I used to hang around in this. It was a Texaco station. You're familiar with the area. It was like right at the on-ramp of Sepulveda between Venice and Washington. Used to have the U-Hauls there. My stepfather owned it, he became my stepfather. This was later on, but just a whole bunch of guys hung around this place, and I started hanging around it when my mother first met him, I had never had so many friends, and everybody was drinking and smoking pot and doing all kinds of hallucinogenics, and you know, this was like the late 60s, and I felt like I was a part of life at last, right? Because I hooked into this way of life I was there, I'd arrived. So I make these little notes as I go through Bill's story, and as it goes down, it talks about various things, and again, I can't read all of it, but on the same page, it talks about ominous warnings which I failed to heed. And I underline that, and in the margin I write little warnings that I had early on, you know, about in the beginning of my drinking, where I saw that, you know, this should have been a sign. You know, stopping school just the same point that I started smoking pot might have been a good sign, right? You know, people coming to me early on telling me with how much you're drinking when I was a teenager should have been a good sign, you know. Ominous warnings which I failed to heed. So I go all the way through Bill's story, setting aside the differences, underlining what I could relate to, making little notes of how I relate to it. And I ended up, as do most people that I work with, they ended up underlining a lot. And it brings me to a great question that's actually, I look at it on page 8, but it's on page 17. The question comes from page 17. So was I as hopeless as Bill? Because if I could go through Bill's story and relate to a lot of it, then to ask the question, was I as hopeless as Bill? And understanding what hopeless means, to me, hopeless means wants to quit but can't. Right? You know, and it's interesting that Bill put the story up front here and we present it this way, because because most people that I've worked with who are alcoholics, or let's just say everybody I've worked with that was alcoholics, can, and even addicts, can relate to a lot to Bill's story. And when it comes to that question, you know, the response is, yes, I was just as hopeless as Bill. Right? So from page 1 to page 8 was, I underline what I relate to that Bill did. And from page 9 to 16, Bill goes into his recovery. And I underline, what am I not willing to do to recover that Bill did? Right? So, as I got in touch with what was wrong with me physically, you know, and read these parts in the book and relating to it. There's all different kinds of things that's outlined in the workbook here to relate to that I couldn't relate to until I really understood the definitions. Like on page XXX, where it talks about the psychopathic personality. Here's the definition of a psychopathic personality. A person characterized by emotional instability, lack of sound judgment, perverse and impulsive, often criminal behavior, inability to learn from experience, amoral and asocial feelings, and other serious personality defects. He may or may not have insane attacks or symptoms. Right. So understanding the words in the book, I think, are really important. And a lot of definitions are in here that I found in dictionaries that will help you relate to that. But if you could relate to that, that part, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. Unable to learn from my own experience, right? How many times did I lose control of how much I drank and never got the idea and never grasped the concept that once I start, I couldn't stop, right? And the book is going to outline a couple different types of drinkers for me. It says, talks about on page 20, at the very bottom, where it talks about the moderate drinker. It says, moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they had good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. Did you have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely? Could you take it or leave it alone? Right? I couldn't give up liquor entirely. I couldn't take it or leave it alone. Yeah. I found myself walking to the liquor store many times, standing in the corner thinking the only way I wasn't going to cross the street to buy a bottle of booze was to jump out in front of one of these cars. Right? That wasn't me. I'm not a moderate drinker. Then we have the certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. Did you? It may cause him to die a few years before his time. Could it? If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate. So was there anything that happened in your life that was that allowed you to stop or moderate? For her? For your health? Change of environment? Warnings of a doctor? Right. You know, I couldn't relate to the hard drinker because although I certainly drank hard, right, there was no thing that happened in my life that I was willing to stop for or could stop for. I couldn't stop for love, right? Wasn't going to stop for her. A hard drinker is the kind of person that can go into a 28-day program and come out and everything's great and never has to worry about it again. Needed a little bit of help to dry out, but life straightened out for him. But what about the real alcoholic? It's on page 21 now. He may start off as a moderate drinker, and he may or may not even become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. Right? And when I read that, I saw that, you know, that was me. Right? There was times that I drank harder than others. You know, the times that I drank a little less were certainly good excuses to think that I had gotten some control or that it wasn't as bad as the other times when I had less control. So there was, over the years, there was variations of the intensity of my drinking. And when it was lighter, it just was the ideas that I hung on to validate that it's not so bad. But the truth is, I couldn't control that. Right, that once I started drinking, then I didn't know what the outcome was going to be. You know, how much I was going to drink, how many days I was going to drink. Right? I just continued to drink till I got to that point where it was done. When I got to that place, sometimes 3 drinks, sometimes 10 drinks, or 15 drinks, sometimes 3 days, sometimes 30 days. Right. So I look at the physical part of the problem up until the top of page 23, and in this part, this question starts on, or the consideration starts on the bottom of 22. We know while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens both in the bodily and mentally sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. So this is the last statement where, in the book, where it talks about the physical problem. So the question here is, does my drinking experience abundantly confirm that once I start drinking, it's impossible for me to know where it's going to stop? Right? And that's the alcohol becomes the primary over any other important situation in my life. Yeah, I remember I had a phone call from a woman in Australia, and she says, "I don't understand the physical part of the problem. I don't know that I have it." So we started to talk about her drinking a little bit, and I tried to present a couple ideas to her in order to trigger her telling me something about her. And what came out of it was she was saying she would start to drink in the afternoon, and she would continue to drink past the time that she was supposed to pick up her kids from school, you know, and many times wouldn't pick them up, and they would start calling around until somebody else that was on the list picked the kids up. And that was repeated over and over again. And I tried to explain, well, is it possible that is a good situation in your life where you had every reason in the world to want to be responsible, especially in a situation where the school and who knows who else is going to find out about you not picking up the kids at school, yet you started drinking in the afternoon and you continued to drink, and it had you, and it was more important than anything else in your life. You could not, you were no longer drinking for the effect, but just drinking to satisfy a craving beyond your mental control. And she still didn't get it. You know, so in there we have to realize that there is an insanity that goes along with this. Because if I could get it, then, okay, I see that I lose control when I start. And this next paragraph on 23 is the beginning of the mental part of step one. It says, these observations about my lack of control once I start to drink would be academic, meaning it's good to know. But it's pointless if I just never took the first drink, right? So the fact that if I could see that I lose control once I started, then the solution is don't start, right? Right, right. So that kicks off the second part of my problem, is because even if I see that I lose control, there is a subtle insanity that will take me to that first drink. With every good intention of controlling it, every good intention to meet my responsibilities, to show up at work, to show up at school, take care of the kids, to take care of my business. But there's something that always takes me, this insanity that always takes me back to this place, right? And I have to see it as just that, as insanity, because it can't describe it as anything else. The inability to rationally think about this problem in sufficient enough to stop me from taking that first drink. Right? It says in the middle of page 23, it says, once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is an obsession that somehow, someday, they'll beat the game, but they often suspect it's down for the count. I went the last 2 years of my drinking like that. See, I don't believe I was powerless through all of this lack of control. While I was living the way I wanted to live and doing the things I wanted to do, and I didn't care what you thought about that, that's not powerless, right? I am doing what I want to do. But there came a point when I no longer wanted to continue this way of life. Right? And I didn't really know much. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I didn't understand the whole, you know, that there was anywhere to go. I thought that nobody really knew what I was going through. And I went 10 years wanting more than anything to change the way I was living. Right? And it was in that two-year period that I started to get in touch with the powerlessness in my life that had me completely baffled. You know, why would I walk to the liquor store telling myself I don't want to do this, unable to turn around, unable to stop, right? You know, it was easily rationalized, well, I'll just drink less, but it, you know, then you start drinking. And so that this mental insanity kept taking me back to the physical lack of control or inability to control it. I had lost the ability to control not drinking. And on the top of 24, it says, at a certain point of the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. Right? My most powerful desire to stop drinking was of absolutely no avail. You hear in meetings people say that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. You know, but obviously, based on this statement, it's not the only requirement to stay sober. Right? If I can see that my most powerful desire to stop drinking couldn't stop me. Okay, so there's a few things that you hear around the program, and one of them is the idea of choice. You've heard that probably. I choose not to drink. Look what it says in the first indented paragraph of 24. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reason yet obscured, have lost the power of choice in drink. Where so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent, we are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory and the suffering of humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. Right? If you're powerless, then you've lost the power to choose whether or not you're going to drink it. Right? I've lost the power of choice. And we'll talk a little bit more about that a little later when we talk more about insanity. And the other thing you hear in meetings, people tell you, let's just think the drink through, right? You've heard that? Right. Look at the next paragraph says. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time I'll handle myself like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. Now, Bill uses a variation of that last line later on, right? When he's referring to insanity and touching a hot stove over and over again. Right? And that's the subtle insanity. It's, I have an effective mental defense against touching a hot stove. Right? I know that if I touch it, it'll hurt. It'll burn me. Right? Yet, why is it, where was that effective mental defense when I would tell myself, I know I shouldn't be drinking like this, while I'm walking to the liquor store, right? You know, it's insane. It's nothing less than insane, right? Now, one of the things about the depth of this insanity isn't even touched by what I hear in meetings. How many of you have heard the definition of insanity as doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results? You've heard that? As long as you expect different results, you have hope. Right? I drank to the point where I didn't expect different results. I drank to the point where I thought that I was never going to be able to get out of this. Right? I drank to the point of hopelessness. where I thought that there was no way to stop drinking. Right? Now that's insanity. Knowing, you know, being in a place where you're doing something that's harming you, that could kill you, and you can't stop doing it. Right? People get locked up for less. It's not surprising that alcoholics originally just got sent to insane asylums to protect themselves from themselves. Right? Okay. It goes on to say, the last paragraph, when this sort of thinking has fully established himself in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he's probably placed himself beyond human aid, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. Right? You know, and that was me. Right? I thought I was crazy. Why is it that I continue to do this? Right? I was brought to the place where I absolutely didn't want to live like that anymore. Yet the thought would come to my mind, and I would go. You know, sometimes I'd catch myself waking up in the morning, and before I'd even open my eyes, the first thought that would come to my mind was, when was I going to get up and walk to the liquor store? Right? You know, and that was a disturbing thought. Right, looking back and seeing that I was trapped in a place that I had absolutely no idea how to get myself out of. And I really, really believed that nobody understood where I was at. I was seeing a therapist. At $70 an hour, we'd sit and talk, and he didn't once say, hey, why don't you go to an AA meeting? Didn't once say that. He tried real hard to help me, but there was something about me that couldn't get any help that direction. I'm not putting therapists down now, don't get me wrong. I think anything that gets me to close further to my own truth is going to be helpful. Right? But I needed more than what that person had. Right? He was unable to give me what I needed. So, So the point here is that I want to make sure we sum up, and I'm going to jump ahead to the last page in the mental part of this problem. And that's on 43, where it says, once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any human can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. Right? I wish I had more time to go over more of this, but 6 hours is actually not enough time. You know, which was naturally years ago before I've ever done something like this. It's how could I ever fill this much time? You know, and then after doing it, right away, you just realize there's just so much stuff in here to grab onto and to experience that it's just not enough time to do it in a day. So, but again, using this as a guide, if I can get you a little excited about looking heavier into this and into the big book, you know, this will guide you through a lot of questions that hopefully will convince you exactly this. That an alcoholic of my sort at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Right? And no human power can take that away from me. Right? There's an insanity in my mind that will tell me, and people carry that way into years of sobriety, not understanding, you know, the consequences of that. Right? I have to see the level of my insanity in order to by the idea that they're trying to lead me up to in the second step, that I need a power greater than myself to restore that sanity, right? We talked about the idea of choice a few pages back. When it comes to insanity, there's some points I'd like to make. And if we go to the top of that this page, the same page on 43, where this person says, "My old manner of life was by no means a bad one, but I would not exchange the best moments for the worst I have now. I would not go back to it, even if I could." He says he would not go back to it, even if he could. Right? This talks about an incredible change in this person's thinking. He had no choice. There was no choice. He could not go back to drinking. "If I'm insane, then when the thought comes to my mind, I can't do anything but drink. If that's true for me, then my solution is to be restored to sanity. Because if I'm restored to sanity, then I could not go back to it. I could not choose to go back to it. There's still no choice. So there's no choice but to drink if I'm insane, and I can't choose to drink if I've been restored to sanity." Right? So I have to see that there's some place for me to get here. Right? I have to be moved from this place of insanity to something better than what I have now. Right? Right? But the good news is there is a solution. Right? But I'm going to leave you with a question to ponder until we come back, because there's a third part of step one to look at. If I have an insane mind that takes me to this first drink, where the physical problem takes over and I lose control of how much I drink, and that happens over and over and over again, then I see that my mind takes me to the first drink. The obsessions take me to that first drink. Wouldn't it be important to know what sets up the condition for the obsessions? Right? So remember that in the beginning it talked about this being a basic text, starting with addition, then subtraction, then multiplication, right? That's a basic text. It started with the obvious. I lose control of my alcohol. Started with the not exactly obvious, but you're probably still aware of it, the insanity that takes me to the first drink. So now it's going to start to get more interesting, because now it's going to get into parts that you couldn't even think of on your own. So what sets up the condition that created grounds where the obsession to drink can come so hard that I can't do anything but drink? All right? So we're going to take a 15-minute break and see you back here soon.